expressing scorn for McKinley and disgust for the deep and damnable alliance between business and politics that Mark Hanna was constructing. White, whose worship of the gold dollar amounted to religion, flinched at this blasphemy, yet within an hour he was converted. I have never known such a man as he, and never shall again. He overcame me. He poured into my heart such visions, such ideals, such hopes, such a new attitude toward life and patriotism and the meaning of things, as I never dreamed men had. So strong was this young Roosevelt, hard-muscled, hard-voiced, even when the voice cracked in falsetto with hard, wriggling jaw muscles and snapping teeth, even when he cackled in raucous glee. So completely did the personality of this man overcome me that I made no protest and accepted his dictum as my creed. Later, they strolled for a while under the elms of F Street, and when they parted, I was his man. Years later, White tried to analyze the elements of Roosevelt's conquering ability. It was not social superiority, he decided, not political eminence, nor erudition. It was something vaguer and more spiritual, the undefinable equation of his identity, body, mind, emotion, the soul of him. It was youth and the new order calling youth away from the old order. It was the inexorable coming of change into life, the passing of the old into the new. When Acting Secretary Roosevelt boarded the battleship Iowa on Tuesday, 7 September, the Virginia Capes had long since slipped below the horizon. Apart from a forlorn speck of color floating some 2,500 yards off, the target for today's gunnery exercises, the world consisted of little but blue sky and glassy water, in which 7 white ships of the North Atlantic Squadron sat with the solidity of buildings. Biggest and most sophisticated by far was the 11,000-ton Iowa, a masterpiece of naval engineering and the equal of any German or British battleship. She was so new that she had not yet engaged in target practice, and many of her crew had never even heard her guns fired. Captain William Sampson welcomed Roosevelt aboard and escorted him to the bridge amid a terrific clamor of gongs. The decks were cleared for action, breakables stowed away, and porthole panes left to swing idly as sailors scampered to their stations. Roosevelt, who had just been lunching with the admiral, looked placid and happy. Word went around that he wanted to see how quickly the enemy could be demolished. The jangling of the gongs gave way to silence, broken only by a general hum of automatic machinery. It was the constructor's boast that almost nothing on the Iowa was done by hand, except the opening and closing of throttles and pressing of electric buttons. A surgeon distributed earplugs to the acting secretary and his party. "Open your mouth, stand on your toes, and let your frame hang loosely," he advised. 2,000 yards, called a cadet, monitoring the ship's course. A few seconds later, there was a silent flash of fire and smoke from the 8-inch guns, followed by a thunderous report that shook the Iowa from stem to stern. Plumes of spray indicated that the shells were 50 yards short of target. A second salvo landed on range, but slightly to one side. Bugles announced that the Iowa's main battery of 12-inch guns was now being aimed at the floating speck. There was an apprehensive pause, followed by such vast concussions of air, metal, and water that a lifeboat was stove in, and several locked steel doors burst their hinges. 2 members of Roosevelt's party, who had forgotten to assume the necessary simian stance, were jerked into the air and landed clasping each other wordlessly. They were escorted below for ear ointment, while Roosevelt continued to squint at the target through smoke-begrimed spectacles. Had it been a Spanish battleship and not a shattered frame of wood and canvas, it would now be sinking. The exercises lasted another 2 days, and Roosevelt returned to Washington profoundly moved by what he had seen.
"Oh, Lord! If only the people who are ignorant about our Navy could see those great warships in all their majesty and beauty, and could realize how well they are handled, and how well fitted to uphold the honor of America."
The hot weather continued until mid-September, and Roosevelt, showing concern for the secretary's health, suggested that he extend his vacation through the beginning of October. This, however, even John D. Long was unprepared to do, and he sent word that he would be back on 28 September. Roosevelt took the news philosophically, for by then he had realized his ambition to consult with the president as acting secretary, not once, but 3 times. Hitherto, their meetings had been pleasantly impersonal, but now, for some reason, McKinley seemed anxious to flatter him. On 14 September, he requested Roosevelt's company for an afternoon drive. He confessed that he had not looked at the naval policy of the president's pamphlet until he saw what press interest it aroused, whereupon he read every word of it and was exceedingly glad it had been published. McKinley then made the astonishing remark that Roosevelt had been quite right to criticize Japan's Hawaiian policy at Sandusky. Finally, he congratulated him on his management of the Navy Department during the past 7 weeks. Roosevelt took all this praise with a pinch of salt. "The president," he told Lodge, "is a bit of a jollier." But he detected nonetheless a substratum of satisfaction. Swaying gently against the cushions of the presidential carriage, relaxed after a day of stiff formalities, William McKinley appeared to best advantage. Locomotion quickened his inert body and statuesque head, and the play of light and shade through the window made his mask-like face seem mobile and expressive. Roosevelt could forget about the two short legs and pulpy handshake and concentrate on the bronzed, magnificent profile. From the neck up, at least, McKinley was every inch a president, or for that matter, an emperor, with his high brow, finely chiseled mouth, and Roman nose. "He does not like to be told that it looks like the nose of Napoleon," the columnist Frank Carpenter once wrote. "It is a watchful nose, and it watches out for McKinley." Not until the president turned and gazed directly at his interlocutor was the personal force which dominated Mark Hanna fully felt. His stare was intimidating in its blackness and steadiness. The pupils, indeed, were at times so dilated as to fuel suspicions that he was privy to Mrs. McKinley's drug cabinet. Only very perceptive observers were aware that there was no real power behind the gaze. McKinley stared in order to concentrate a sluggish, wandering mind. Taking advantage of the president's affable mood, Roosevelt touched delicately on the possibility of war with Spain and Japan. McKinley agreed that there might be trouble on either front. Roosevelt made it clear that he intended to enlist in the army the moment hostilities began. The president asked what Mrs. Roosevelt would think of such action, and Roosevelt replied, "This was one case where he would consult neither her nor Cabot Lodge." Laughing, McKinley promised him the opportunity to serve if war by any chance arose. 3 days later, Roosevelt received an invitation to dine at the White House, and 3 days after that went for another drive in the presidential carriage. This time he made so bold as to present McKinley with a Cuban war plan of his own devising. It proposed a 2-stage naval offensive, first with a flying squadron of cruisers, then with a fleet of battleships, all dispatched from Key West within 48 hours of a formal declaration. If the army followed up quickly with a small landing force, he doubted that acute hostilities would last more than 6 weeks. "Meanwhile, our Asiatic squadron should blockade and, if possible, take Manila." By 17 September, Roosevelt was beginning to feel guilty about dear Secretary Long rusticating in New England, especially when the Boston Herald printed a mocking story about his desire to replace the old man altogether. He wrote to Long in quick self-defense, protesting his loyalty and subservience rather too vehemently, and ending with a rueful, "There! Qui s'excuse, s'accuse." But the secretary took no offense, and proclaimed his entire satisfaction with Roosevelt at a dinner of the Massachusetts Club in Boston. "His enthusiasm and my conservatism make a good combination," Long said, adding with a twinkle, "It is a liberal education to work with him." Had Long known what Roosevelt was up to on the eve of his return to Washington, he might have employed stronger terminology. On Monday, 27 September, the acting secretary intercepted a letter from Senator William E. Chandler to Long, recommending that Commodore John A. Howell be appointed commander-in-chief of the Asiatic Station, the very post Roosevelt wanted for Dewey. Howell, though senior, was in his opinion irresolute and extremely afraid of responsibility. The prospect of such an officer leading an attack upon Manila was too depressing to contemplate. With Long due back the following morning, rapid action was necessary. Roosevelt sent an urgent appeal to Chandler. "Before you commit yourself definitely to Commodore Howell, I wish very much you would let me have a chance to talk to you. I shall, of course, give your letter at once to the secretary upon his return." Presumably, Senator Chandler could not be persuaded, for he withdrew neither his recommendation nor his letter. Throwing all caution to the winds, Roosevelt called in Dewey. "Do you know any senators?" The Commodore mentioned Redfield Proctor. Roosevelt was delighted, for Proctor had expansionist tendencies and was known to be influential with the president. Dewey must enlist his services at once. Senator Proctor obligingly went over to the White House and spoke to McKinley in behalf of the little Commodore. He might have made discreet reference to the fact that Roosevelt also favored Dewey. The president, who took little interest in naval affairs, accepted his advice without question and wrote a memorandum to Secretary Long requesting the appointment. Long returned to the Navy Department on 28 September and was greatly annoyed to find what political intrigues had been going on in his absence. Tradition required that he appoint the senior officer, and besides, he personally favored Howell. But McKinley's memo could not be ignored. And so, to quote the sonorous words of Theodore Roosevelt, "In a fortunate hour for the nation, Dewey was given command of the Asiatic Squadron." The secretary was still in an irritable mood when Dewey called to thank him and apologize for using the influence of Senator Proctor. It had been necessary, Dewey explained, to counteract Senator Chandler's recommendation of Howell.
"You are in error, Commodore," snapped Long. "No influence has been brought to bear on behalf of anyone else."
A few hours later, Long, in turn, sent apologies to Dewey. It appeared that Senator Chandler had indeed recommended his rival, but the letter had arrived while he was absent from the office and while Mr. Roosevelt was acting secretary, and had only just been brought to his attention. The culprit was serenely unrepentant about his delay in forwarding Senator Chandler's letter, and saw nothing wrong in Dewey's enlistment of senatorial aid. "A large leniency," Roosevelt wrote, "should be observed toward the man who uses influence only to get himself a place near the flashing of the guns." By 30 September, Roosevelt was free to go north for a fortnight's rest at Sagamore Hill. Before leaving, he asked the secretary's permission to talk to him very seriously about the need for an increase in the Navy. He proceeded to urge the instant construction of 6 battleships, 6 large cruisers, 75 torpedo boats, and 4 dry docks, together with the modernization of 95 guns to rapid fire, the laying in of 9,000 armor-piercing projectiles, and the purchase of 2 million pounds of smokeless powder. Long could only suggest that Roosevelt list these demands in a memorandum. The assistant secretary was eventually persuaded to settle for 1 battleship. Roosevelt was back in Washington on 15 October, accompanied by his wife and family. Installing them at 1810 N Street, a very nice house just opposite the British Embassy, he set off almost immediately on the campaign trail, stumping in Massachusetts for local candidates and in Ohio for Senator Hanna. On 27 October, he turned 39. With November came the familiar seasonal quickening of his activity as the days shortened and crisp winds stimulated his blood. The ground of Rock Creek Park grew harder under his hobnailed boots as he and Leonard Wood strolled their endless visionary miles, talking of Cuba, Cuba, Cuba. Roosevelt's duties as assistant secretary were not numerous enough to divert him, and he began to show signs of intellectual restlessness. He plotted 4 more volumes of The Winning of the West, took Frederick Remington to task for rendering Badgers too long and thin, and yearned for a war with Spain within the next month. Long sympathetically appointed him president of a board investigating the Navy's most chronic ailment, friction between line and staff personnel. The resultant workload was heavy, yet Roosevelt now toyed with the idea of writing a historical article on the Mongol Terror, the domination of the Tartar tribes over half of Europe during the 13th and 14th centuries. Early in the morning of 19 November, he sent joyful news to Bammy. "Very unexpectedly, Quentin Roosevelt appeared just 2 hours ago." Pausing only to enter the boy for Groton, he marched off to work and dictated his most bellicose letter yet to Lieutenant Commander W. W. Kimball, author of the department's original war plan. "To speak with a frankness which our timid friends would call brutal, I would regard a war with Spain from 2 standpoints. First, the advisability on the grounds both of humanity and self-interest of interfering on behalf of the Cubans. Second, the benefit done our military forces by trying both the Navy and Army in actual practice." On 8 December, he heard that Dewey had sailed for the Far East, but by now he was so busy writing the report of his personnel board that he paid little attention. The 8,000-word document, submitted the following day, proposed a bill for the prompt amalgamation of line and staff on the grounds that engineers, in an industrial age, could no longer be held separate from or inferior to officers above deck. Roosevelt inserted one of his typical historical parallels, showing how in the mid-17th century, sailormen and sea soldiers had to unite and resolve their differences in much the same way. "We are not making a revolution," he wrote. "We are merely recognizing and giving shape to an evolution." Secretary Long complimented him highly on the report, as did many naval academics and newspaper editors. The New York Evening Post expressed admiration for his grasp and breadth of view of highly complicated material. If profound study, evident freedom from bias, and command of the subject could place a report above criticism, nothing would be left to do but the enactment by Congress of the proposed bill. Shortly before Christmas, the mammalogist C. Hart Merriam announced that a new species of Olympic mountain elk had been named Cervus rooseveltii in honor of the founder of the Boone and Crockett Club. It is fitting that the noblest deer of America should perpetuate the name of one who, in the midst of a busy public career, has found time to study our larger mammals in their native haunts and has written the best accounts we have ever had of their habits and chase. And so the year ended with a crescendo of praise for Assistant Secretary Theodore Roosevelt, who was now recognized to be one of the best informed and most influential men in Washington. He was also, as the Boston Sunday Globe pointed out, by far the most entertaining performer in the great theater of our national life. But it would never do to permit such a man to get into the presidency. He would produce national insomnia. Chapter 23. The Lieutenant Colonel. "What was that?" said Olaf, standing on the quarter deck. "Something heard I like the stranding of a shattered wreck." The new year was not 12 days old when a riot disturbed the uneasy peace of Havana, Cuba. Spanish officers smashed the presses of 4 local newspapers critical of the occupying army. The violence lasted about an hour, long enough to convince the nervous U.S. Consul General, Fitzhugh Lee, that the lives of American residents were in danger. He sent home some urgent dispatches, and the State Department flashed a message to Captain Charles D. Sigsby of the USS Maine at Key West, Florida. $2. While Captain Sigsby pondered that cryptic cable, a prearranged code alerting him to be ready to steam for Cuba at a moment's notice, Assistant Secretary of the Navy Theodore Roosevelt pondered the first press reports of the riot. Next morning, Thursday, 13 January, he went into John D. Long's office and shut the door. The secretary was amusedly aware that his subordinate intended to abandon everything and go to the front in the event of war with Spain. Roosevelt had said so at least twice already, but today he was in such fierce earnest that Long wondered if he had not gone daft in the matter. Attempting to jolly him back to his senses, the secretary called him a crank and ridiculed his desire to get involved in some bushwhacking fight with Cuban mosquitoes. But Roosevelt would not be diverted, as Long noted somewhat pettishly in his diary. "The funny part of it all is that he actually takes the thing seriously. He bores me with plans of naval and military movement and the necessity of having some scheme to attack arranged for instant execution in case of an emergency. By tomorrow he will have got 6 heads of bureaus together and have spoiled 20 pages of good writing paper and lain awake half the night. Happily, the latest dispatches of this afternoon are to the effect that everything is quiet again." Roosevelt soon realized that the flurry in Havana was no real threat to American security, but he volunteered his services, just in case, to his friend General C. Whitney Tillinghast II, Adjutant General of New York. "I believe I can get a commission as a major or lieutenant colonel in one of the National Guard regiments, but I want your help and the governor's. I have served 3 years in the state militia, not to speak of having acted as sheriff in the cow country, and I believe that I would be of some use." Meanwhile, Edith was lying alarmingly ill at 1810 N Street, having collapsed with suspected typhoid fever 9 days before. Roosevelt was exceedingly put out by this inconvenience, for it obliged him to cancel a trip to the annual Boone and Crockett dinner in New York. To make matters worse, little Ted was suffering from nervous exhaustion. Roosevelt's own attitude to disease and frailty was the same now, in his 40th year, as it had been in his 14th. If one ignored them long enough, presumably they would go away. No illness, not even the mortal kind, must deter him from leaving for the front at the first hint of war. But the trumpets did not blow for him that freezing January day. He worked off his frustrations, as the secretary had predicted, by spoiling 20 pages of good writing paper in the form of a memorandum on naval preparedness and deposited it on Long's desk the following morning. The document was signed, "Yours respectfully," but in its urgency and peremptory statement of facts, it read more like a curt set of orders. Roosevelt warned of serious consequences for the Navy Department if it allowed itself to drift unprepared into war. "Some preparation can and should be undertaken on the mere chance of having to strike. The saving in life, money, and reputation by such a course will be very great." He advised, insisted, that vulnerable U.S. cruisers and gunboats currently scattered about the high seas be concentrated at strategic points for possible blockade duty in Cuba and the Philippines. This redeployment must begin at once, since even a fast cruiser like the Cincinnati would take 30 days to steam north from South America and would arrive home without any coal. In other words, for the first 5 or 6 most important weeks of the war, these vessels will be absolutely useless, Roosevelt wrote, temporarily forgetting that war had not yet been declared. Such ships should be recalled tomorrow and assembled at Key West, where they could fill up with coal and be ready for instant battle orders. He was confident that Dewey, his man in Hong Kong, had enough ships to overmaster the Spanish Asiatic Squadron, but just to make sure, the vessels now patrolling Hawaii should add their gunpowder to the Commodore's. On the eastern seaboard, a flying squadron composed of powerful ships of speed and great coal capacity should be readied for instant dispatch to the Canaries, whence it might attack Cadiz, or slip through Gibraltar by night and destroy Barcelona. The memorandum ended with rapid-fire demands for more ammunition, men, and colliers. "When the war comes, it should come finally on our initiative, and after we have had time to prepare." Roosevelt's fine writing paper was not altogether wasted. Something about his impetuosity and almost fierceness persuaded the secretary to order the Cincinnati and several other South Atlantic cruisers into equatorial waters and station a small force at Lisbon where it could monitor Spanish naval movements. Meanwhile, the formidable North Atlantic squadron, which Roosevelt had seen in practice the previous fall, joined the Maine at Key West, ostensibly to begin winter exercises, and proceeded to fill up with coal. Long, surprisingly, went even further than Roosevelt in suggesting to President McKinley that the Maine should be detached and sent to visit Havana as an act of friendly courtesy. McKinley sounded out the Spanish minister, Enrique de Puy-de-Lôme, on this subject, and etiquette required His Excellency to express diplomatic delight. The president was, after all, his own accredited host. But de Lôme's private attitude may be judged from a letter he had written to a Spanish friend a few weeks previously. "McKinley is weak and a bidder for the admiration of the crowd, besides being a would-be politician, politicastro, who tries to leave a door open behind himself while keeping on good terms with the jingoes of his party." Unknown to de Lôme, the letter did not reach its destination. The Maine dropped anchor in Havana Harbor on the morning of 25 January 1898. Spanish officials went aboard in polite but chilly welcome. Captain Sigsbee, not wanting to exacerbate local feelings, announced that there would be no leave for his crew. Contrary to expectations, no demonstrations of welcome or protest broke out in the city, and a relieved Consul General Lee cabled, "Peace and quiet reign." Roosevelt might have reacted more gratefully to the administration's sudden decision to make a show of naval force had his domestic worries not intensified in the last days of January. Edith was running a constant fever and could not sleep for the pangs of sciatica. Ted's strange nervous condition was worse, and Kermit, too, was sick. The presence of a squalling 2-month-old infant in the house was an added distraction. On top of all this, Roosevelt now discovered that he had personal tax problems in New York. Last summer he had filed an affidavit stating that he was a resident of Manhattan in order to avoid a heavy assessment in Oyster Bay. In New York, however, his assessment turned out to be even heavier, making him wish he could cancel the original affidavit. Family physicians and accountants were pressed into service, while the assistant secretary waited restlessly for further news from Havana. On the last day of the month, Henry Cabot Lodge made an eerie prediction. "There may be an explosion any day in Cuba, which would settle many things." For a week, nothing happened. Then, on 9 February, William Randolph Hearst's sensational New York Journal published on its front page the text of Minister de Lôme's undelivered letter, under the banner headline, "Worst Insult to the United States in Its History." The paper announced that an agent of the Cuban insurrectos had intercepted the letter on the eve of its delivery and sent it to another agent in New York, who in turn gave it to the journal for publication. All possible doubt as to the document's authenticity was avoided by printing it in facsimile. While ordinary Americans fumed over Delhomme's characterization of their president, students of foreign policy boggled at the implications of his concluding paragraph. It would be very advantageous to take up, if only for effect, the question of foreign relations, and to have a man of some prominence sent here in order that I may make use of him to carry on a propaganda among the senators and others in opposition to the rebel junta. In other words, the Spanish government appeared to be totally cynical in its relations with the United States and its promises to help secure some sort of autonomous government in Cuba. To add insult to injury, Minister Delhomme, who had once admitted that he had indeed written a letter, cabled his resignation to Madrid before the State Department had a chance to demand that he be recalled. Thus, the United States had to be content with an inadequate Spanish apology, referring in sarcastic tones to mail theft and sensation-mongering newspapers. That night, a highly excited Theodore Roosevelt accosted Mark Hanna and two other senators at a reception. In his haste to urge war upon them, he did not notice that Hanna was accompanied by Henriette Adler, a young Frenchwoman recently arrived from Paris. Roosevelt launched into a typical fist-smacking harangue, and Mademoiselle Adler found herself wedged between him and the wall. She tried to follow what he was saying, but was distracted by his flailing right arm, which swept nearer and nearer her bodice. Eventually, his elbow ripped off a silken rose and some gauze, whereupon she exclaimed, "Mon Dieu!" Roosevelt, wheeling, made profuse pardon. To her alarm, he continued to pour war rhetoric upon her in French until Nanny Lodge tactfully appeared with a safety pin. The senator screened Mademoiselle Adler off while Roosevelt switched back to English. "It was a bully idea," he proclaimed, "to send the Maine to Havana." Senator Hanna said nothing but stood listening with his jowls sunk on his white tie. Mademoiselle Adler, decent again, ventured a suggestion that the United States should consider the opinion of other European powers before attempting to crowd Spain out. France and Germany were bound to object to any denial of imperial rights in the New World. She had heard a statement to this effect herself in Paris only 2 weeks before. The assistant secretary waved France's scruples aside as unimportant and irrelevant. "I hope to see the Spanish flag and the English flag gone from the map of North America before I'm 60." Hanna stared at him. "You're crazy, Roosevelt. What's wrong with Canada?" Later, in the carriage back home, Mrs. Hanna tried to explain to the dazed Mademoiselle Adler that Roosevelt, despite his abnormal vehemence, was more amusing than violent. But the senator, chewing on his cigar, thanked God Roosevelt had not been appointed Assistant Secretary of State. "We'd be fighting half the world," he growled. Incendiary talk was common in the days following the Maine's arrival in Havana Harbor, from Henry Cabot Lodge's threatened explosion to Mark Hanna's waving a match in an oil well for fun, and the more personal misgivings of Mrs. Richard Wainwright, wife of the cruiser's executive officer. "You might as well send a lighted candle on a visit to an open cask of gunpowder." But as mid-February approached, and life in the Cuban capital drowsed on as normal, even Consul General Lee began to relax. On the evening of the 15th, tourists aboard the liner City of Washington, just arrived in Havana Harbor, leaned on the railings and admired the Maine's sleek white beauty 400 yards away. The air was hot and motionless, and the harbor scarcely heaved. Its stillness was such that they could hear accordion music coming across the water. Tropic dark came quickly, and the tourists went below to dinner. About 2 hours later, another strand of music sounded from the Maine. The sound of a bugler blowing taps. Its melancholy beauty caused Captain Sigsby, who was writing in his cabin, to lay down his pen and listen until the last echoes died away. He looked at his watch. The time was exactly 9:40 p.m. About 4 hours later, Secretary Long was awakened in his Washington home and handed a telegram. The first sentence alone was enough to banish all further thought of sleep. "Maine blown up in Havana Harbor at 9:40 tonight and destroyed." Long's eye, running on across the sheet, leaped from phrase to incredible phrase. "Many wounded, doubtless more killed or drowned. No one has clothing other than that upon him. Public opinion should be suspended until further report." The telegram was signed Sigsby. Within minutes, Long telephoned the White House and ordered a naval attaché to rouse the president. It was not yet 2 in the morning, and McKinley absorbed the secretary's news with some difficulty. After hanging up, he paced back and forth in front of the bewildered attaché, mumbling slowly to himself, "The Maine blown up? The Maine blown up?" Meanwhile, the telegraph wires were still humming, shocking the State Department, Navy Department, and New York newspaper offices into action. In little more than an hour, Joseph Pulitzer's World had broadcast the first report of the disaster under a 4-column headline. Not to be outdone, James Gordon Bennett sprang the story across 6 columns of the Herald, and William Randolph Hearst gave it the entire front page of the Journal. "This means war," he told his night editors. By dawn, the news, complete with a transcript of Captain Sigsby's report, was thumping onto front porches all over the country and stimulating newsboys to new heights of shrillness. No doubt some of them repeated McKinley's own phrase, "The Maine blown up!" In the face of such a catastrophe, presidents and paupers spoke with but one voice. Dawn in Cuba disclosed that the Maine was indeed a total wreck. The explosion, which took place somewhere in the forecastle, had jackknifed the keel up to the level of the bridge, killing 254 men instantly. A further 8 were so badly crushed and burned that they died 1 by 1 in hospitals ashore, bringing the death toll to 262. What was left of the ship lay wedged in the mud of Havana Harbor, with only a few blackened parts of the superstructure showing above water. As to the cause of the explosion, Spanish authorities were apparently no wiser than the Americans. Until the Navy Department's Court of Inquiry reached Cuba and made its report, there could be no official reaction on either side, beyond expressions of sincere sympathy in Havana. The Governor General, Ramon Blanco y Arenas, had been seen crying openly in his palace, and the Bishop of Havana spared no expense in giving the dead an elaborate and dignified burial. Popular opinion in America was surprisingly muted, in contrast to the clamor of the yellow press, thanks to Captain Sigsby's wise plea for emotional restraint. There was also a widespread suspicion that the explosion had been internal and accidental. Secretary Long shared this view. The Maine's forecastle, after all, had been packed with gunpowder, and its steel-walled magazines, laced around with electric wiring, needed only a short-circuit fire to convert the whole ship into a bomb. Besides, it was hard for thinking people to believe that Spain would deliberately sabotage an American cruiser with a secret infernal machine, as Hearst's journal alleged. Should the Court of Inquiry prove otherwise, of course, there was no question that the man in the street would expect a declaration of war at once. This was an alternative President McKinley could hardly bear to contemplate.
"I have been through one war," said the ex-Union major. "I have seen the dead piled up, and I do not want to see another."
A rather more junior member of the administration had no such scruples, and no doubts as to who was responsible for the disaster in Havana Harbor.
"The Maine was sunk by an act of dirty treachery on the part of the Spaniards, I believe," wrote the Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Roosevelt doubted that the Court of Inquiry would be able to prove his theory of Spanish guilt, but he waited on edge for its initial findings, in the hope that they would at least absolve the Navy of responsibility for the explosion. Notwithstanding his private judgment, he scrupulously used the word accident in departmental correspondence. Hearst was not so patient. The Maine's burned-out hulk had scarcely cooled before his artists were rendering pictures and diagrams to show exactly where and how the infernal machine had struck, in response to the push of a plunger on shore. On 18 February, the day before the official inquiry opened, the Journal published no fewer than 8 pages of conclusive data, some of it so detailed that even Captain Sigsby wondered if the paper did not have secret contacts with the saboteurs. Sales of the paper reached an unprecedented 1 million that morning. Meanwhile, the enterprising Pulitzer bought and dispatched a tugboat to Cuba to learn and report on the truth. Within a week, his own paper, The World, had sold 5 million copies, the largest circulation of any newspaper printed in any language in any country. More responsible newspapers, such as the Evening Sun, cautioned readers that the true facts of the disaster were not yet known and might be slow in coming. The Maine's bow was reported buried so deep in the mud of Havana Harbor that digging would be needed to get at the break. Day after day passed with no announcement by the court, until, "Is there anything new about the Maine?" became an impatient refrain of everyday conversation. One passenger on a New York electric car was heard to remark that if the Assistant Secretary of the Navy took over the investigation, results would be forthcoming in no time. Teddy Roosevelt is capable of going down to Havana and going down in a diving bell himself to see whether she was stove in or stove out. A helpless victim of the gathering tension was Edith Roosevelt, whose fever heightened to the point that Roosevelt, for the second time in his life, was confronted with the prospect of death in his bedroom. He confessed that he was so extremely anxious about her as to be numb to the full consequences of the Maine disaster. As for his son, "Hereafter I shall never press Ted, either in body or mind. The fact is that the little fellow, who is peculiarly dear to me, has bidden fair to be all the things I would like to have been and wasn't, and it has been a great temptation to push him." On the morning of Friday, 25 February, Edith's weakness finally shocked him into seeking the best medical help available. He sent to Johns Hopkins University for Sir William Osler, the great Canadian physician, and left for work as usual in what torment posterity can only guess. It so happened that John D. Long was also feeling the strain that morning. Since his violent awakening on the night of the 16th, the secretary had been plagued with insomnia, along with various aches and pains, which he carefully noted in his diary. He had discovered that relief was to be had in mechanical massage, a treatment whereby a Washington osteopath strapped him into an electrical contrivance that soothingly jiggled his stomach and legs. Long now felt the need of renewed treatment, so much so that around noon he resolved to take the rest of the day off, leaving Roosevelt in charge of the department as acting secretary. The mechanical massage was most satisfactory, and the secretary proceeded to visit his corn doctor, after which he walked about the streets in an aimless way and finally headed for home, unaware of the cablegram even then winging halfway around the world. "Dewey, Hong Kong. Order the squadron, except the Monocacy, to Hong Kong. Keep full of coal. In the event of declaration war Spain, your duty will be to see that the Spanish squadron does not leave the Asiatic coast, and then offensive operations in Philippine Islands. Keep Olympia until further orders. Roosevelt." This momentous message, which Dewey later described as the first step toward American conquest of the Philippines, was by no means the only order Roosevelt issued during his 3 or 4 hours as acting secretary. He sent similar instructions to keep full of coal to squadron commanders all over the world, and to make sure they got it, authorized the Navy's coal-buying agents to purchase maximum stocks. He alerted European and South Atlantic stations to the possibility of war, and designated strategic points where they were to rendezvous in the event of a declaration. He ordered huge supplies of reserve ammunition, requisitioned guns for a Project Auxiliary fleet, and summoned experts to testify on the firepower of the Vesuvius. He even sent demands to both houses of Congress for legislation authorizing the unlimited recruitment of seamen. Having thus, in a single afternoon, placed the Navy in a state of such readiness it had not known since the Civil War, Roosevelt wrote a strictly confidential letter to warn Adjutant General Tillinghast of the New York National Guard that the world situation was sufficiently threatening to warrant plans for statewide mobilization. "Pray remember that in some shape I want to go." After work, he paid a courtesy call to Secretary Long. If he gave any report on his actions during the last 4 or 5 hours, it was of such masterly vagueness that no memorandum of the conversation appears in Long's diary. Yet something about Roosevelt's enthusiastic and loyal manner made the secretary uneasy. "If I have a good night tonight, I shall rather feel that I ought to be back in the department." Refreshed by splendid slumbers, the secretary hurried back to work next morning, Saturday, 26 February. He would have gone whether he felt better or not, "because during my short absence I find that Roosevelt, in his precipitate way, has come very near causing more of an explosion than happened to the Maine. The very devil seemed to possess him yesterday afternoon." War preparations in the Navy Department were now moving at such a pace that it would take long days to slow the momentum, let alone stop it. The evidence is that the secretary did not even try. For all his anger and embarrassment over "action most discourteous to me, because it suggests that there had been lack of attention," Long was forced to defer to the workings of an intellect larger and a political instinct sharper than his own. None of Roosevelt's letters and cables was countermanded. even the historic order to Dewey was allowed to stand. But Long resolved never to leave Roosevelt in sole charge of the department again. The times were too trying, and the assistant secretary had severe family problems, which could only aggravate his natural nervousness. Long did not understand that extreme crisis, whether of an intimate or public nature, had precisely the reverse effect on Theodore Roosevelt. The man's personality was cyclonic, in that he tended to become unstable in times of low pressure. The slightest rise in the barometer outside, and his turbulence smoothed into a whirl of coordinated activity, while a core of stillness developed within. Under maximum pressure, Roosevelt was sunny, calm, and unnaturally clear. History was to show that his behavior as acting Secretary of the Navy on 25 February 1898 was neither nervous nor spontaneous. It was the logical result of 10 months of strategic planning at the Navy Department and at the Metropolitan Club, in his correspondence with Captain Mahan, and on his walks with Captain Wood. "Someday," Roosevelt told the latter confidently, "they will understand." Sir William Osler examined Edith over the weekend and confirmed that she was critically ill. There was an abdominal swelling which should be operated on at once. For some unexplained reason, Roosevelt ignored this warning and relied instead on more cautious advice. Edith lay wasting with fever for another week, too frail even to stand the sound of his voice reading to her. On 7 March, all opinions concurred that she must undergo surgery or die. He sat holding her hand until ether removed her from him. The operation revealed an abscess near the hip and was completely successful. Roosevelt's contempt for peace-at-any-price men rose to new heights as he watched William McKinley trying to avoid war in the weeks following the Maine disaster. Certainly the president showed a touching faith in the benign effects of gold currency. His first proposal was that the United States end the Cuban problem once and for all by buying the island outright for $300 million. But Congress showed reluctance to put such funds at his disposal, and the plan was dropped. Then, on 25 February, the same day Roosevelt alerted Dewey to the imminence of war, McKinley reportedly suggested that if the Court of Inquiry found Spain responsible for the loss of the Maine, a large cash indemnity would assuage America's grief. Congress did not like this idea either. "An honest man, but weak," the French ambassador Jules Cambon remarked of McKinley. By early March, when preliminary divers' reports indicated that a mine might have caused the explosion, the president was desperate enough to use scare tactics. He flabbergasted Joseph Cannon of the House Appropriations Committee with a request for $50 million, saying, "I must have money to get ready for war. I am doing everything possible to prevent war, but it must come, and we are not prepared for war." McKinley intended this to be his political masterstroke, silencing warmongers in both Washington and Madrid with a sudden display of presidential decisiveness. At first, the move seemed bound to succeed. Congress reacted with such shocked surprise, probably assuming the president was in possession of secret evidence of Spain's hostile intentions, that on 8 March, the $50 million bill became law without a single dissenting vote. McKinley was authorized to spend the money as he saw fit. Spaniards and Cubans boggled at the wealth of a treasury which could produce such a huge appropriation in extra defense funds with no effect upon its credit. It was announced that the bulk of the appropriation would be given to the Navy Department for a crash program of naval expansion. Construction of 3 12,500-ton battleships was to begin immediately, supplemented by 16 destroyers, 14 torpedo boats, and 4 monitors. In addition, the department could assemble a large auxiliary fleet of ships purchased abroad. Roosevelt was not as overjoyed as he might have been by the president's apparent conversion to the doctrine of preparedness. 9 months before, at the Naval War College, he had warned against the futility of any such last-minute attempt at naval expansion. The Maine Court of Inquiry was due to publish its formal report any day now. If it corroborated his own suspicion of sabotage, "I believe it will be very hard to hold the country." What use would McKinley's construction program be then? His only hope of improving the present strength of the Navy lay in the auxiliary fleet program. The ink on the $50 million bill was scarcely dry before Roosevelt and Long began to review all available war vessels on the international market. News that Spain was already bargaining for ships inspired even the secretary to a sense of urgency, although he continued to hope illogically that the buildup would have some deterrent effect. Roosevelt was given a special responsibility for purchasing merchantmen suitable for quick conversion into cruisers. Among the many dealers who flocked to his office was one Charles R. Flint, who assessed him as a young man at the very peak of his truly tremendous physical and mental energy. The assistant secretary was obviously in a tearing hurry. Flint started to tell him about the Brazilian ship Nictoroi, but Roosevelt knew all about her. Roosevelt, what is the price? Flint, $500,000. Roosevelt, snapping, I will take her. Flint, good, I shall write you a letter. Roosevelt, don't bother me with a letter, I haven't time to read it. We eventually did have a formal contract, Flint noted, dictated by Mr. Roosevelt. It was one of the most concise and at the same time one of the cleverest contracts I have ever seen. He made it a condition that the vessel should be delivered under her own steam at a specific point and within a specific period. In one sentence, he thus covered all that might have been set forth in pages and pages of specifications. For the vessel had to be in first-class condition to make the time scheduled in the contract. Mr. Roosevelt always had that faculty of looking through details to the result to be obtained. Every now and again, President McKinley would indulge in a little banter with his assistant attending surgeon, Leonard Wood. Have you and Theodore declared war yet? No, Mr. President, but we think you should. McKinley always shook his head when the handsome officer asked to be returned to active duty in the Army. Wood worked off his growing restlessness with more and more violent exercise with Roosevelt. The pair were now inseparable, and Roosevelt began to include Wood in his regular appeals to General Tillinghast. I have a man here who rendered most gallant service with the regular army against the Apaches, whom I should very much like to bring in with me if I could raise a regiment. Mid-March came and went. Forsythia, magnolia, hyacinths, and tulips sweetened Washington's warming air. Still, the Court of Inquiry delayed its main report. In an atmosphere of mounting political tension, Senator Redfield Proctor of Vermont prepared to deliver a speech on Cuba, which he had just visited. Proctor, despite his friendly assistance in behalf of Dewey the previous fall, was by no means as ardent for the war as Roosevelt supposed. He was a careful, rather colorless politician, respected on all sides as a former cabinet officer, a friend of big business, and an intimate of President McKinley. When he rose in the Senate on 17 March, the nation listened. Speaking coldly and dispassionately, Proctor confessed that he had gone to Cuba an isolationist and returned with views inclining toward armed intervention. For the next several hours, he catalogued the horrors he had seen, most notably the barbaric indignities of reconcentrado camps, where 400,000 peasants were living like pigs and dying like flies. After discussing Spain's promises of autonomy with certain eminent Cubans, he was convinced that the authorities would never yield power, and that the insurrectos would never cease to fight for it. To me, he concluded, the strongest appeal is not the barbarity practiced by Weyler, nor the loss of the Maine, but the spectacle of 1.5 million of people, the entire native population of Cuba, struggling for freedom and deliverance from the worst misgovernment of which I ever had knowledge. The effect of this toneless speech, after months of fiery oratory for and against war, was so great as to convert large numbers of conservative senators to the cause of Cuba Libre. Even more significantly, Wall Street's hitherto solid resistance to war now began to crumble, while business groups across the country expressed profound concern. Political observers predicted that if McKinley did not intervene upon receipt of the main report, whatever it said, Cuba Libre would become the campaign cry of the Democrats in the fall. And who can doubt, asked the Chicago Times-Herald, that by that sign they will sweep the country. 3 days later, on 20 March, the president was confidentially informed that the Court of Inquiry would soon make a unanimous report that the Maine was blown up by a submarine mine. Some inkling of this message must have reached Roosevelt, who vented his wrath in a positively Elizabethan outburst to Brooks Adams. The blood of the Cubans, the blood of women and children who have perished by the 100,000 in hideous misery, lies at our door, and the blood of the murdered men of the Maine calls not for indemnity, but for the full measure of atonement, which can only come by driving the Spaniard from the New World. Events moved rapidly to a climax. On 24 March, the Navy ordered squadron commanders to paint their white warships battle gray. On 25 March, the American minister in Madrid was warned that Spain's presence in Cuba was now considered unbearable by the administration, and that unless an immediate diplomatic settlement was reached, the president will lay the whole question before Congress. And on 26 March, Roosevelt publicly confronted Senator Hanna, one of the last holdouts for peace, at a Gridiron Club after-dinner speech, which had the whole Capitol agog. "We will have this war for the freedom of Cuba," he insisted, and smacked his fist into his palm. Then, wheeling and staring directly at Hanna, he said that the interests of the business world and of financiers might be paramount in the Senate, but they were not so with the American people. Anyone who wanted to stand in the way of popular opinion was welcome to try the experiment. Hanna's porcine neck turned purple, and his knuckles tightened on the arms of his chair as applause filled the room. "Now, Senator," said his neighbor dryly, "may we please have war?" On 28 March, the Maine report was finally made public. Although the court made no accusation of Spanish or Cuban guilt, there being absolutely no incriminating evidence, it confirmed that the explosion of the ship's forward magazines had been touched off by an external device, and absolved the U.S. Navy of any fault or negligence in the disaster. Within hours, a new ominous chant was drowning out calls of Cuba Libre. "Remember the Maine! To hell with Spain!" Almost unnoticed in the general uproar was a historic memo from Theodore Roosevelt to John D. Long. He wished to draw the Secretary's attention to the flying machine of his friend Professor S.P. Langley, having watched it briefly flutter over the Potomac River. "The machine has worked," Roosevelt wrote. "It seems to me worthwhile for this government to try whether it will not work on a large enough scale to be of use in the event of war." He recommended that a board of 4 scientifically trained officers be appointed to examine the strategic and economic aspects of producing flying machines on a large scale. After some prodding, Secretary Long agreed, and named Charles H. Davis chairman of the board. By the time Davis reported on the revolutionary potential of air warfare, the assistant secretary had moved on to other things. It would be a long time before Roosevelt was recognized as the earliest official proponent of U.S. naval aviation. Haggard, smudge-eyed, drugged, and occasionally tearful as the inevitability of war forced itself upon him, President McKinley managed to maintain statesmanlike decorum at least through the end of March. While Congress debated the Maine report, he sent an ultimatum to Madrid, courteously demanding a declaration of armistice in Cuba, effective 1 April. His terms stipulated that he be mediator of any subsequent negotiations for peace between the Spanish government and the insurrectos. If no agreement was reached by 1 October, i.e., 5 weeks before the fall elections, McKinley would assume the role of final arbiter. He also insisted that all reconcentrado prisoners be set free, and that Spain cooperate with the United States in relief efforts. On Thursday, the last day of the month, Queen Maria Cristina's ministers agreed to all points of McKinley's ultimatum, except that of armistice. If the insurrectos wished to declare a truce themselves, well and good. Spain would not end 4 centuries of New World dominion with an ignominious acceptance of defeat. McKinley saw no flexibility, only obstructionism in this reply. After a weekend of sleepless deliberation, he decided, around midnight on 3 April, that he could not afford to gamble with Cuba, or with Congress, or with the Republican Party any longer. The will of the American people, reiterated ad nauseam by Assistant Secretary Roosevelt, whom in self-defense he had finally stopped seeing, must be heeded. McKinley went to bed, and next morning, began work on a war message to Congress. The imminence of war, like the imminence of death, is enough to give the most ardent soul a momentary pause, to reaffirm basic truths and articulate thoughts long held in suppression. In such frame of mind did Theodore Roosevelt write one of his best letters, to William Sturgis Bigelow, while Madrid pondered McKinley's ultimatum. For once he wrote calmly, reasonably, without any attempt at vulgar bravado. "I say quite sincerely that I shall not go for my own pleasure. On the contrary, if I should consult purely my own feelings, I should earnestly hope that we would have peace. I like life very much. I have always led a joyous life. I like thought, and I like action, and it will be very bitter to me to leave my wife and children.
and while I think I could face death with dignity, I have no desire before my time has come to go out into the everlasting darkness. So I shall not go into a war with any undue exhilaration of spirits, or in a frame in any way approaching recklessness or levity. But my best work here is done. One of the commonest taunts directed at men like myself is that we are armchair and parlor jingoes who wish to see others do what we only advocate doing. I care very little for such a taunt, except as it affects my usefulness, but I cannot afford to disregard the fact that my power for good, whatever it may be, would be gone if I didn't try to live up to the doctrines I have tried to preach. Bigelow, unimpressed, told Secretary Long that Roosevelt might by the same token wear no clothes in the street to prove that he is not a Negro. The President had decided to send his war message up to the Hill on Monday, 4 April, but hints from Madrid that further concessions might be made mañana caused a postponement until Wednesday the 6th. Belligerents in Congress, who now comprised a majority, did not see why they should have to wait two more days, or for that matter two more hours, before settling with the butchers of Spain. When the message was postponed a second time, in order to allow for free evacuation of American citizens from Cuba, frustrated legislators crowded the White House so threateningly that McKinley was obliged to lock the precious document in a safe. "By God," one senator growled to Assistant Secretary of State Rufus Day, "don't your president know where the war-declaring power is lodged?" As always, Theodore Roosevelt produced the most quotable insult. "McKinley has no more backbone than a chocolate eclair." 7 April was Holy Thursday in Havana. Under lowering skies, bands throughout the city played soothing sacred music. On Good Friday, Roosevelt assured his classmate Bob Bacon that he did not want to annex Cuba, only to free it from medieval fiefdom. "Let us fight on the broad grounds of securing the independence of a people who, whether they amount to much or not, have been treated with hideous brutality by their oppressors." On Saturday, the American minister in Madrid was told that at the behest of the Pope, Spain would declare an armistice in Cuba after all. On Easter Sunday, the minister followed up with a personal appeal to McKinley. "I hope nothing will now be done to humiliate Spain." But on Monday, 11 April, the President finally sent his message to Congress. Debate still rages as to whether by doing so McKinley confessed his inability to hold the dogs of war any longer, or whether a study of Cuban history persuaded him that Spain's promises were not to be believed. If he wanted peace, why did he not keep the message locked up and announce that, thanks to the armistice, a diplomatic victory was at hand? If he wanted war, why did he not send in the message sooner? Perhaps the President realized that nothing he thought or said was of much consequence now. America, as Theodore Roosevelt kept saying, needed a war. "I have exhausted every effort to relieve the intolerable condition of affairs which is at our doors," McKinley told Congress. "Prepared to execute every obligation imposed upon me by the Constitution and the law, I await your action." During the week that Congress took to debate McKinley's message, pausing once to roar out an impromptu chorus of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Roosevelt redoubled his efforts to secure a commission in the Army. There is no question of the Assistant Secretary of the Navy applying for service at sea. "I shall be useless on a ship," and he was equally determined not to become part of the garrison in a fort. Preliminary mobilization was ordered on 15 April, well in advance of any declaration of war, and he at once began to pester the Secretary of War, Russell A. Alger, and General-in-Chief Nelson A. Miles. Neither man impressed him. "Alger has no force whatsoever. Miles is a brave peacock," he wrote in a new pocket diary. "They both told me they could put 100,000 men in Tampa in 24 hours. The folly, the lack of preparation are almost inconceivable." Frustration at the slowness of Congress to act, at his own inability to get a place in any New York regiment, vented itself in further jabs of angry ink. "The President still feebly is trying for peace. His weakness and vacillation are even more ludicrous than painful. Reed is malignantly bent on preventing all preparation for war." Fortunately, there was one department in the administration ready and willing to fight. "Long is at last awake. I have the Navy in good shape." Posterity will not grudge him that boast. The Navy was, indeed, in superb fighting trim as he prepared to resign from office.
What it lacked in sheer weight of metal is made up in efficiency and combat toughness. Never before had it been so strategically deployed. Never was it so ready for instant action. In comparison, the Spanish Navy, though numerically superior,